The lights are on red. We're away.
Welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, October 12th, and this is episode number 99. I am Bob Hayes, your host here this week, as always, to bring you some news and information about MotoGP and motorcycle road racing. Unfortunately, we have to start this show off on a very sad note. Motorcycle racer Norifumi Abe has passed away in a traffic accident in Japan. Norik Abe, is better known as, was riding a scooter in Kawasaki City near Tokyo, and a truck made an illegal U-turn in front of him, and unfortunately, Norik then collided with the side of the truck and was thrown from his scooter across the road and suffered injuries that later resulted in his passing away. He basically fractured some ribs, and this punctured his aorta, and he ended up bleeding out in the hospital. He was conscious and aware enough that when paramedics arrived on the scene, he was able to tell them who he was. They transported him to hospital, and approximately 2 hours later, he passed away. This is a real tragedy. Norik Abe was a fantastic road racer. He's been in MotoGP. He was currently in the Japanese Superbike Series. It's just a horrendous tragedy, and it's very, very, very sad. And the one thing that we can learn about from this is that we, as motorcycle riders, or as scooter riders, for that matter, how much we have to be aware of our surroundings. Now, there are some things that are completely unavoidable, and we have to analyze the risks involved and whether or not it's sort of worth the risks to participate in our chosen sport, the things that we like. I mean, I'm fortunate enough that I live in a fairly rural area. I tend to ride on fairly quiet roads, but I know a lot of people that say, you know, they ride motorcycles at a track on track days or doing racing or things like this that people think are dangerous, but they don't ride on the street simply because they feel it's too dangerous. And it's just a horrific tragedy for Norik to have passed away in such a way, and he leaves behind his wife and his family. He's got a small child. He was only 32 years old. Very, very sad. Our condolences go out deeply, very deeply to Norik's family. But I don't want to sort of lessen anything of this tragedy, but it happens all the time to regular folks. Norik Abe happened to be a name that we know, somebody that we know and understand as a motorcycle racer, but this happens all the time, and you just cannot be too careful out there. So if you're riding a motorcycle or a scooter, you cannot be too careful. And if you're driving in your car, you must be aware of where motorcycles are around you and double check your blind spots and all of these sorts of things to try to watch out for this. So very, very sad news. Not a good week for racing there, motorcycle road racing, with Norik Abe passing away. Not a good month because for racing in general, what with Colin McRae's accident and the helicopter accident a few weeks ago. But in any event, if you would like to send some condolences to the family of Norik Abe, one of our listeners in Japan who gave me some information about the whole event and provided a few links, which I will put up on the website, to some Japanese news sites that will show you some of the stories that were on Japanese news about this tragedy. However, you can go ahead and send me an email and I will forward it on, and it will get to Norik Abe's family if you wish to express your condolences to them. And we here at MotoGPOD most definitely express our condolences. It's just a horrific tragedy, and we're very, very upset about it. So, moving on, other than that, we've got some really interesting stuff to talk about on the show today. Sorry to start the show off on sort of a bad note, but it's had to be said, and it's something that, like I said, we're moving on. We're going to go past it. First thing I do want to mention is that MotoGPOD received a donation this week from Steve Jones, and thank you very much, Steve. I do appreciate that. So, moving on, the rest of the show, we've got some interesting stuff today. We're going to talk a little bit about the news. We're going to have a not so much a tech segment as a technique segment that Darren Carpenter, longtime MotoGPOD listener and friend of MotoGPOD and racer at the OMRA series up in Portland and Track Day Buddy and all that, Darren helped us out and he sent us this technique segment. We're going to talk a little bit about clutchless shifting and false neutrals and things that you can run into. And this actually helped us out when we were down there at the track day, learned a few things, and Darren was nice enough to put it all on paper so I can share that with you. And then, of course, we're also going to have a big, long conversation with Liam Schubert, our man in Spain, working there for the Premacdantin Ducati racing team. And we had a great conversation talking about all kinds of interesting stuff, threw out some interesting reader emails of sort of technical questions, and Liam was nice enough to answer them. We talked a little bit about the setup that they're going to be working with, Phillip Island, whatever, all kinds of stuff. The conversation was just all around great, really went well, had a very, very enjoyable call with Liam. And, of course, we wish him the very best of luck out there. And as we are recording this, the first practice, the free practices, sessions 1 and 2, have already happened there at Phillip Island because we've got Phillip Island racing this weekend. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. So without any further ado, why don't we go ahead and get on with the rest of the show? Let's talk a little bit about World Superbike. First of all, I want to express my disappointment at Speed TV in the United States for delaying the last two races of the season, where the championship is at stake, and literally down to the wire amongst three racers. We didn't actually know the results of this championship until the last round of the series. We went into that last round with Toseland with a 29-point lead, and there were three riders, James Toseland, Noriyuki Haga, and Max Biaggi, all with a chance of winning that championship. And Speed TV chose to not broadcast it on Sunday and instead tape delayed it until Tuesday. I couldn't believe that. Not only both races, not just, you know, one race. Lately, they've been showing one race on the Sunday and then they show the second race on Tuesday. They just put both races on the Tuesday. I was a little disappointed. Unfortunately, in my preparation for the show and all that, I couldn't print out the Speed TV schedule of what they actually showed on Sunday because they'd already sort of deleted it off their website. But I'm sure it was a bunch of really great NASCAR stuff and maybe, you know, a few repeats of unique whips and whatever pinks and the crap that they show. So I was quite disappointed in that. But when they finally did actually show the races on World Superbike, or maybe you caught it online or Eurosport or wherever it is that you follow your World Superbike, these are some good races, let me tell you. I mean, it was really great stuff. If you haven't seen the races yet, if you've got them taped or TiVo'd or whatever you do, you might want to skip the next few minutes of the show because I'm going to spoil the results. But what a race. It was just fantastic stuff. Very, very close. Both races were real edge of the seat kind of events. Lots of, you know, very close racing action. World Superbike has been fantastic stuff this year. I haven't covered it enough because there's just so much in MotoGP to cover. But really, I think that overall, when you compare season to season as a whole of what the whole season has to offer, World Superbike has been a better bet this year than MotoGP. You know, World Superbike is still not quite MotoGP, and they know it over there because Jonathan Green sort of has this inferiority complex going on with World Superbike, but it's a fantastic racing nonetheless. These are production motorcycles, but they're not the same exact motorcycles that you and I can go by. Sure, they have the same name, and they start off roughly the same, but they've been quite considerably tweaked and tuned and everything and turned into very, very serious racing machines, and we've got some fantastic stuff going on. So, for the last race, which was held at Magny-Cours in France, we went into that, like I said, Toseland had a 29-point lead. 25 points per race are on the table, so with a double header going on, that's 50 points. If Toseland had had some sort of, you know, disastrous first race, he very well could have lost that championship. 29 points was in no way a lockup. You know, it was a nice lead, and Toseland was in good shape, but it didn't necessarily prove to be the best thing because in race one, Toseland got an incident in the first corner with Lorenzo Lonzi and went right off track. Lonzi crashed a horrific, scary crash going on and was taken to the clinic and all of that. But Toseland managed to stay on the bike, a superb display of riding skill as he rode through the gravel trap and managed to keep it upright and everything. But by the time he came back out on track after that first corner, he was dead dog last and way, way behind. However, just like color commentary guys Scott Smart said, Tozelin, at least this happened on the first lap when he did have a chance of catching up because the pack was still, you know, a pack. There was still, you know, a compacted group of riders and all of that sort of thing. Everybody was quite close. So Tozelin managed to catch up. He started making up ground very, very rapidly. And we saw an exciting race with Tozelin and Biaggi way back down the order, but just battling ahead for every spot, every position on up the line. Now, what ended up happening at the end of that race, race number one, was that Noriyuki Haga from the Yamaha factory team, well, actually not truly a factory team, supposedly, but the Yamaha Motor Italia team, riding a YZF R1, Noriyuki Haga took the win. Troy Bayliss on a Ducati came in second, and Troy Corser on the other Yamaha came in third. So Haga had a fantastic race. And just, you know, managed to pull it off and got his podium. Haga is a fantastic rider. He sort of, every time he's been there, it's just been a little bit of just not quite his season, perhaps. And really, in some ways, this should have been his season. He should have been the guy, but there's just been various things happening in World Superbike, and so he didn't get his championship going on. And it's such a shame that he should have won the championship this year in many ways. Tozelin has run a fantastic season, there's no doubt about it, but Haga has also, and it was it's cool to see Nitro Nori in action. It really is. Tozelin ended up finishing that first race down in seventh, finished behind Biaggi, who was in sixth. Like I said, it was a fantastic race all around. If you're into the sort of, you know, bumping means racing kind of an attitude, then this was one of the races to watch. That's for sure. It was super, super good stuff. But that put us into the championship. Haga had picked up 12 points on Tozelin at that point. So Tozelin still had the lead for the championship, but it was still, again, in no way a locked deal. Biaggi was out of the running, but it was still down to the very last race of the season between Haga and Tozelin. Race two was a little bit of a different story. Tozelin got a pretty good start, but just sort of started fading fast. He may have been riding on a sort of a maintenance mode kind of thing going on, where it's just like, you know I have to finish high up in the points. Haga's still behind me, and as long as he, you know, basically Tozelin's thinking, don't crash. And I think that's kind of the race that he ran. The Hondas didn't do as well as they've done at many of the other tracks, but nonetheless, I think Tozelin was a little restrained, might be the way to put it. So that race two, also another super exciting race, and that one finished up with Haga, Biaggi, and Nieto on the podium there, 1, 2, and 3. Troy Corser came in fourth, and Tozelin was down in the order there after Bayliss in fifth, and then Tozelin was in sixth. However, this did lock up the championship for Tozelin, so he managed to pick that up, his second World Superbike Championship. They were saying, you know, following in the footsteps of Carl Fogarty and all this goodness, blah, blah, blah. Tozelin won the race and won the championship, and came out good. And it was a well-deserved win. He had a fantastic season overall, and I think that he did real well, and it's going to be exciting to see him in MotoGP next year. Now, what that means for World Superbikes next year remains to be seen. It's still going to be a good series, and I think we're going to see some really, really good stuff from it next year. So, moving on, because this is MotoGP OD and not World Superbike OD, let's talk a little bit about first thing that we got going on. This is a slight tiny news item of the Red Bull US Grand Prix. Laguna Seca has a thing on their website talking about the Red Bull US Grand Prix ticket alert. Hospitality tickets along with the reserved and premier camping for the 2008 Red Bull US Grand Prix will go on sale Thursday, November 1st at 8 a.m. Pacific Standard Time via telephone. Now, the premier camping spots, you pretty much have to be locked in. If you went there last year, you have priority, and you have to sort of wait for somebody to decide not to go or to, you know, die or whatever else before you can get a spot. But don't forget, if you are one of those holders, November 1st, and give them a call. Their phone number is 800-327-SECA. That's 800-327-7322. Now, all the remaining tickets, paddock passes, grandstand seats, parade lap, and general camping, which means a big grassy field, will be available beginning Monday, November 5th at 8 a.m. Pacific Standard Time via that same telephone number, 800-327-SECA, or online at www.laguna-seca.com. And don't forget, you want to set that up. If you live in the United States or even in North America, you must go to the Red Bull U.S. Grand Prix at Laguna Seca. They put on a fantastic event this year, and I'm sure that 2008 will be another one to match. Now, we do have a choice of two MotoGP races next year because Indy is also there, and Indy tickets have been on sale for quite a while, which you can take a look there at the, I think the website URL is RedBullIndianapolisGrandPrix.com. If all else fails, email me and say, Bob, that website doesn't work, and I want to talk to you about that and all that, and I'll send you the right one. But I'm pretty sure that's right, RedBullIndianapolisGrandPrix.com, and you can get tickets for that, or look for the tickets for RedBullUSGrandPrix.com, which is at Laguna Seca, starting November 5th. For the peons like myself that don't have that priority camping pass and all that goodness. Next thing we got going on, Phillip Island's coming up this weekend. We've had a lot of buildup for this race. Yes, these last three races in the season, Phillip Island, Malaysia, and then Valencia, they are going to be somewhat of a lame duck race because we've already established our champion. However, we have not established number two. Valentino Rossi is still in a battle with Danny Pedrosa as far as who is going to finish second in the championship. Valentino Rossi is not used to being second in the championship. This is not a good thing for him. He certainly doesn't want to finish third, so there's going to be some good racing going on there. And don't kid yourself that Stoner's not going to try his hardest, particularly at Phillip Island, which is his home race. Yeah, that guy's out there to win, and I think he's also going to be pushing it hard for those last several races. So in some ways, these last three races could be the best races of the season because that championship is no longer at stake. So don't give up on MotoGP yet. We've heard a lot of complaints and all of that about processional racing, and it's just not as exciting and all of that. But don't forget, the beginning of this season, we thought it was the best season ever and how great everything was, and things are closing up. Honda's getting their game together. Yamaha's improving. Suzuki and Kawasaki are doing the best they've ever done. We just have one sort of spoiler in the mix, if you will, and that is Casey Stoner is just doing so well on the Ducati that he's making everybody else look bad in comparison. But there's some fantastic racing left in MotoGP, and that's going to carry us right on through November, which is really late and kind of cool. All the other series are finishing it up and doing their, you know, wet races and a variety of different things, but MotoGP is going to carry on through the beginning of November. So we're looking forward to that. And we have two special liveries going on in Phillip Island. Yamaha is running both their motorcycles with a Fiat Abarth sort of livery that has the scorpion for Abarth. They're bringing back that name for their cars and all of that. So they're going to be running that. Kind of curious how that looks. And Christopher Millen is running a special Barry Sheen commemorative livery going on. And again, kind of interested in seeing how that one looks because Barry Sheen's a big inspiration for Christopher Millen. So we're looking forward to that. Casey Stoner had in free practice one, which like I said earlier on, has already occurred. The few free practice sessions have already occurred by the time I'm recording this. And Stoner dominated both of them. He went through the first free practice. He's on several occasions during his remarkable world championship winning season this year, Ducati Marlboro's Casey Stoner has gone on to dominate an entire weekend after starting Friday free practice in good form, and he will be hoping to do that again at Phillip Island over the next 48 hours, having made a solid start to the proceedings. Blah, blah, blah. It is wet at Phillip Island, and we were wondering about the weather and how the weather would affect things, and that there's a possibility of rain and all that. Starting to look like this weekend might be a wet race that could bring some interesting things into the mix. We see different people on the podium, we see different strategies going on. We'll just sort of have to see exactly how that shapes out through the race weekend itself, and so we actually do the race. But in any event, that first free practice session finished up with Casey Stoner on top with the fastest time, doing a 131.132, which, let's see, that's still a long ways off Nicky Hayden's circuit best lap from 2006, but that's understandable seeing it's wet and it's free practice one where everybody's just sort of getting their feet wet, so to speak. Second, Randy Dupuynier. Third, Valentino Rossi. Fourth, John Hopkins. Fifth, Danny Pedrosa. So we won't go down the entire order there for free practice one because these are just the free practice times, and it's relatively meaningless as far as the whole race weekend is going. However, Casey Stoner is on top of things. For Free Practice 2, which just finished up just as I was recording this all, we had Stoner again on top with a 2:03, that's his last lap. His best lap was a 1:31.286. And then Marco Melandri and Danny Pedrosa, Valentino Rossi down at fourth, and Randy Depunier, who we're hoping to see. Well, I'm not necessarily hoping to see, but certain listeners are hoping to see Randy Depunier with his leathers taken off. Although that would mean that he had crashed, which is not an entirely unusual occurrence. But so we're not hoping necessarily for the crash, but we do want to see his torso. Right. Moving on. I think that's going to about cover the initial sort of things that we have going on with MotoGP at Phillip Island. We're going to talk a little bit more about it here in our call with Liam that's coming up here a little bit later on in the show. It's always a good race, and we've got a lot of listeners down in Australia. I've had a lot of people sending me emails and telling me how they're getting ready to go, and they're going to send pictures and all kinds of stuff. So hopefully we can combine some of that stuff and have that for our next show, which is number 100. So we're sort of hoping to do a few special things for episode number 100, but it's all the usual MotoGP OD thing where we don't bother planning anything until like the Wednesday before we actually have to record the show. So, we'll have to see. Episode 100 might be pretty much like episode 99, but that doesn't mean that it's bad. It's always good stuff here at MotoGP OD. We got a lot of positive feedback about last week's tech segment on pneumatic valves. So if you missed that, make sure you catch episode 98. We had a tech segment by Scott Jones that was really great about pneumatic valves. And I got a lot of feedback again, like I said. And one of the things I got was actually a question from Joshua, and he's talking about the whole track day experiences and all that sort of thing that we talked about in 98. And he says, your retelling of your track day brought something to mind from my recent crash, so I thought I'd ask you. I've read lots of articles on how to apex a turn, street turning strategies versus the track, braking, trail braking, etc. But there's one type of turn for which I have not yet read a technical description, and that is an off-camber downhill corner. Here's the story that brought about this question. I was taking out my 2003 Buell Firebolt down my favorite local twisty road, and one of the corners is a steeply downhill, slightly off-camber left-hander. I got into the corner and I realized that I couldn't keep the suspension compressed because any throttle application would increase speed significantly due to the downhill element of the turn. That fact spooked me, and I target fixated on the ditch, and after some sloppy use of the brake, I ended up with a wounded knee and a few scratches. I'm fine, the bike is fine, but my confidence in my own riding skill has been shattered. So, how should I have navigated that turn? Do I slow way down before the turn so that I could squirt out of it? Or do I trust the tires to stick without rolling on the throttle? So, not being necessarily the best rider in the world, me, I had to put this one out to some of the buddies that I went down there with the track day with. I kind of said, hey, you guys went down there with the track day with me, so you get to help in answering some of the questions. My initial response to the question was that, you know, this turn is a lot like turn 5 at Thunder Hill, where you've got this really sharp left-hander that's leading into a downhill, leading into turn 5A, which is a right-hander, quite bumpy. I wouldn't say it's off camber, but it's certainly not banked. And, what exactly do you do? And what I was doing there is pretty much rolling off the throttle and almost coasting up turn to that initial turn 5, barely tootling around and letting the bike accelerate. So, I mean, you're almost lugging it up turn 5, not downshifting, because all that you're going to have to do is upshift real, real quick once you hit into that downhill section. And, I mean, it's lightning quick how fast the bike picks up speed. So that was my initial reaction. However, I thought maybe I misunderstood the question a little bit, because when Joshua talks about compressing the suspension, I was a tiny bit confused, and I wanted to get a second opinion, basically, not trusting my own riding skills. Because what I've always understood about a downhill turn, and I wouldn't say it's compressing the suspension, although it's the same thing, because you're compressing the rear to extend the front. But basically, you want to keep your weight off of the front of the motorcycle as much as possible. And on normal street riding, what that means is you're clamping the tank with your knees, you're scooched back as far as you can get on the seat, and you're getting your weight off of those handlebars as much as you can so that you have as little weight on the front suspension as possible, and you're maintaining a slight or better positive throttle. You want to make sure that you're slightly up on the gas and accelerating through the turn, and this will extend the front suspension and thus compress the back suspension to a point. And that has always worked for me, but I didn't know when we're talking about off-camber turns and all these sort of things, so I figured it was a good idea to talk to people. And Darren Carpenter, motorcycle racer at the OMRA series, and like I said, track day buddy that helps me out a lot at the track days, he put in his two cents going on. And like I said, the question where we're talking about suspension, compression, and all that, we were a little bit like, well, you know, what's he talking about? So, you know, if we're talking in person with him, we could have asked him a few questions and kind of sort of got exactly everybody's on the same page, but because we weren't, here's Darren's response. He says, off-camber turns give you less ground clearance and they provide less traction. For that reason, I've read, I think this was in one of the Keith Code Superbike books, that you should spend as little time as possible in the turn. Square it off and spit out. But regarding his comment about compressing the suspension, I think that you're misstating why you should apply the throttle in a turn. He's thinking that you need to stay on the throttle to keep the suspension compressed, which is not exactly correct. For any turn, what you want to do is keep your weight balanced between the front and rear tire. So the more weight that you put on that front tire, the more chance you're going to lose it in a low side. For example, if you're riding 60 miles an hour and you have the throttle locked, then you tip the bike over into a turn. That throttle is still locked in the same position. You never increased or decreased it. But since the bike is leaned over, you are now on a smaller radius of the tire. That tire is still turning at the same speed, but since the radius is smaller, you're going to slow down. Right? You following me? So when you slow down, weight will transfer to that front tire. So instead, when you tip the bike into a turn, you want to increase your throttle. And this is exactly what I was thinking, positive throttle. Increase your throttle to increase the tire speed so that you can continue at the same speed and you keep the bike balanced. In the turn, you should gradually increase throttle all the way through the turn. This will help keep the bike balanced and keep more weight on the rear tire, which has a bigger contact patch, and it's easier to control if you start to lose traction than is the front tire. If the suspension is working correctly, it will compress in the rear, and it'll soak up any bumps while in the turn, regardless of what you're doing on the throttle. So I hope that helps there, and I hope that helps all of you. Now, we do have another tech segment, which is also from Darren, because like I said, Darren is he's our resident racer up there at OMRA, and this is a cool session that he did talking about tech segments. And like I said earlier in the intro, it's not so much a tech segment, meaning how does the motorcycle work, but a technique segment of how do you ride that motorcycle and what should you do and all of that sort of thing. So we were talking about false neutrals there when we were doing that track day. And how, you know, every now and then during an upshift, you can do false neutral, and that can really kind of spoil things a little bit when you're trying to pick up speed on that straightaway. So he's going to share this with us, and basically he says, I'm not a gearhead. I would not trust myself to tear apart a transmission and replace the gears. So this information is from what I have learned from my own experience and from talking to many racers and mechanics about how to upshift without using the clutch and without having problems with false neutrals. So when you're hard on the throttle and you're upshifting through the gears, you often get a false neutral between, say, third and fourth gear. Or it'll shift into gear for just a split second, but then it'll pop back down into that gear that you were on, or, you know, again, fall into that false neutral. You want to avoid this. You don't like that false neutral. This is a bad thing. So when Darren first started racing, what happened to him was this whole false neutral thing, and it got progressively worse. At first, he figured that he had just worn out that fourth gear because he was trying to shift from third to fourth gear. He just worn out the fourth gear and that it needed to be replaced. This seemed to make a sense because third and fourth gear are probably the most used gears on any racetrack. When you're coming out of third gear corner, you're often going to be carrying a lot of speed. And you're at full throttle, and when you shift up into fourth gear, and if you're like me, you have a heavy foot when F-shifting, and you're at full throttle because you're thinking, you know, go, go, go. You got to catch that guy right in front of you. So basically, here's what Darren was doing with clutchless shifting the wrong way. He was first learning to upshift through the gears without using clutch, and he would first of all be at full throttle in third gear, driving onto a long straight. But before shifting, he would first preload that shift lever by applying pressure to the shift lever with his foot, then blip the throttle, then, because he's already applying pressure to that shift lever, the bike would kind of automatically slip into the fourth gear, the next gear, because he had blipped the throttle. Now, why this is wrong, and Darren's giving us a little disclaimer here that I don't think he necessarily needs, but I'll go ahead and read it just in case it is wrong. If I was a mechanic, I could probably explain this part better, but I'm not, so I hope it makes sense. When you preload the shifter by applying pressure to the shift lever, the gears bind up. Then, when you blip the throttle, the gears cannot freely shift because they're already bound up. Then, when you release the shift lever, it falls into a false neutral because the gears are never able to fully release from third and engage in fourth. So, here's clutchless shifting the right way. To upshift without the clutch, you want to shift the same way you would as if you were using the clutch, except, obviously, you don't use the clutch because it's clutchless shifting. So, for example, what you're going to do, you're at full throttle in third gear. You do not put your foot on the shift lever. When you're ready to shift, you blip the throttle, and when you're at zero throttle, you've got the throttle all the way closed, then you put your foot on the shift lever, you upshift into fourth, and after you shift into fourth and you get your foot off the shift lever, you reapply the throttle. Now, it's going to take a little practice to get smooth and quick, but this is what's working for Darren out there on the track, and this is what's going to work for most racers on the track. And when you think about it this way, at 100% throttle, the gears are locked and they're turning hard. Then when you blip that throttle, there's no torque or pressure on the gears for just that little moment when you're blipping about it. And then it's going to easily slip into that next gear. Then you're back up to 100% throttle and the gears are locked and turning hard again. So back to Darren's firsthand sort of experience. At the end of his second season of racing, he was getting about one or two false neutrals every lap out of a total of 13 shifts per lap in the races at Portland International Raceway. So he took the bike to his mechanic, which is Vicious Cycle in North Portland. They do great work. And he told him that fourth gear needed to be replaced. Next time on the track, after they replaced the fourth gear, the problem was even worse. So after a long conversation with my mechanic, he explained what Darren was doing wrong and how he should be upshifting. It took him about half a day of practice to get the timing of shifting this way correctly, which is, like I said, where you're not putting any pressure on that gear, you blip the throttle, then you shift, and that sort of thing. But once he got it correct with a little practice and everything, it was pretty easy, and he's not had any problems with false neutral since. Now, Darren says, now I upshift without the clutch on the track and on the street, but I do find that it's easier to upshift without the clutch when I'm charging hard and at full throttle. When I'm street riding, my shifting is not nearly as smooth, but that might be because I practice and ride more at the track and at 100% than I do at the street riding at 70%, which if Darren is riding at 70% on the street, well, I don't want to be around him when he starts getting a ticket because I've seen the guy speed on the track. He's pretty darn good. And if he's riding at 70% of that on the roads of Portland, then he's got a problem. But whatever. Thank you very much, Darren. I do appreciate the little technique segment. I thought it was cool. And I hope that you as listeners out there also think it's cool and maybe learn something about clutchless upshifting. It's always a nice skill to have. It's going to be one of the ways that you're going to get faster if you're on the track. You might want to reconsider it a little bit, somewhat on the street, depending upon where you're at and how you're riding and what you're doing and what the surrounding traffic is like. Because like we talked about in the first segment of the show with Norik Abe, you cannot be too careful out there on the roads, and you always have to constantly be on the watch. However, something like this where you're going from one gear to another can be one way, one tool that you have in your tool chest to get out of trouble as quickly as you can. All right, we got Liam Schubert on the phone. Liam's over in Spain working at the Dantine Pramac MotoGP team, Dantine Pramac Ducati. And how you doing, Liam?
I'm doing pretty good. It's about 12:25 in the morning. I've got about 3 hours until I leave for the airport because I've got a dawn flight that will take me to Amsterdam. And then after a few hours in Amsterdam, I'll fly to Kuala Lumpur Airport in Malaysia. And from there, I'll head down to Melbourne, which is another 8 or 9 hours, I believe. And then a 2-hour drive to Phillip Island. So it's going to be a full day and a half of traveling for me, I believe.
Yeah, that's a lot of traveling. And then I guess you're going to be kind of wiped out from that and have to recover for about a day and a half, huh?
Well, I've been altering my sleep schedule here in Europe for the last few days in preparation for this. You know, generally before a long flight, I will pull an all-nighter and not sleep the night before. That way I'm able to sleep on a plane and wake up refreshed. And since I already know they're about 9 hours different from me over on that side of the world, I took a nice nap through the evening and woke up at 8 or 9 o'clock tonight. That way I will be able to stay awake through tomorrow past lunchtime, which will leave me on my longest flight, hopefully sleeping the most.
That's cool. And then you guys are just going to stay over in Asia for Sepang the following week, right?
Absolutely. On our way back, we'll fly out of Melbourne. I believe our flight is at midnight, the night of the race. So Sunday night, we pack up the boxes, the shipping containers, and then hightail it to Melbourne's airport. We'll fly to Kuala Lumpur and land, I think, Monday morning. Or Monday at some point, we're going to arrive. And then we'll drive to our hotel, which is about 45 minutes outside of Kuala Lumpur. And it's a luxury golf resort. So I think it's probably my favorite hotel to stay at throughout the season. Hmm. At a swimming pool. It's nice.
Yeah. Do you play golf?
No, not at all. Yeah. I tried, I think, hitting some balls at the driving range before, but I think I'm better at chopping wood than playing golf.
Yeah. I'm not a golfer either myself at all, but I thought, you know, it'd be kind of cool for you. You get to go to this luxury golf resort, maybe getting a chance to play around, but yeah.
Yeah, some of the guys are. I mean, there's a few on Marlboro Ducati's team, four or five, that will go out golfing whenever they have a chance, because Phillip Island's also a golf course where the circuit's located. So a couple of the guys will go out from Marlboro Ducati.
That's cool. You know, everybody's got to kind of relax and blow off steam in a different way or whatever. So,
yeah.
Well, it's been a while since we talked to you. I heard you were sick. Are you all over that?
Not really. Flying back out of Japan, we had some incredible weather changes. The Friday and Saturday at the racetrack were extremely hot and humid. And there was a complete flip when Sunday's weather rolled around. It started raining and storming early in the morning, which meant for a wet day. And just something about that weather shift didn't do my system too good. And, you know, it had been a long 2 weeks on the road at that point because we flew immediately from Estoril the previous week to get to Japan. But on the flight back from Japan, it was, you know, one of these crazy older Lufthansa planes that didn't have the air nozzles above your seat so you could turn the air conditioning off. It just had the massive general air conditioning running along the side of the airplane on full blast the whole way.
Oh, wow.
And everybody around me seemed to be under the weather, coughing and hacking. And, you know, it's even though I mummified myself in the blanket that they provide you, I wasn't able to keep it away.
Yeah, no, you have to wear a mask soaked in Pine Sol or something and thing like it's a big joke factory.
Yeah. But that's just one of the small things that, I don't know, you deal with it. I got back, had to do some work, and, you know, so I basically spent my time sleeping and then waking up and sending email and working on some files for Ducati for next season and also for these last three races. I mean, people don't realize how much is involved. And even though the championship's wrapped up and so on and so forth, we've got three more races to go.
Oh, yeah.
And that's three more races with maintenance that we are going to do to the bikes and perhaps a testing after Valencia and a lot of stuff to do. So it's not a racing season. It's a full-time job.
Sure. No, totally understandable. Yeah, because you're getting ready for next season even now, like you were talking during our last call. So, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, in the time that we've had since our last call, I got several emails with really great question suggestions, and it's just sort of been going on. So, if we can, why don't we read some of those?
And, sure.
Yeah, okay, this first one, this is from JT. I didn't get a full name other than JT, and he says, I got a question that I'd like Liam to answer, and talking about bike setup. He says, for instance, Chaz Davis got the ride at Laguna, and it looks like he will be racing for the last three races of the season. So how do they go about setting him up? Do they say, go out and ride, come back and tell us what feels right or doesn't feel right? Or do they have a baseline to work from where maybe they just took Hoffman's settings and then they tune the bike from there? Or do they look at Chaz's size, weight, and riding style and then make some initial adjustments like soft fork springs or something like that and then tune from there? So what can you tell us about that, Liam?
Well, we have a base setting for the bikes that is determined usually before the season even starts as to what the bike runs at say, a track that we're familiar with. So, you know, obviously the test rider, the Bridgestone Ducati test rider and Ducati's own test rider will come up with something they believe is you know, a good base setting, and we'll work from that. Obviously, we knew Chaz was the approximate size of Hoffman because he fit right into the letters. He was tall, and you know, if we sent him out in the first couple of laps to see what his level was at, we can learn quite a bit from the data as far as what he's comfortable with braking, how much stability we need to give him under braking, because obviously everybody rides a bike differently. And we learn quite a bit through studying the data after a general, you know, when the bike is set up in a general format. Then the rider will naturally say something like, it feels like it's shimmying here, or I'm having problems on the gas coming out of here, it feels like this, and we'll adjust off of that, or we'll be able to provide suggestions like, well, this is a characteristic of this machine, we found that this works better, or you might have to alter a riding style. You know, there's quite a bit that goes into it, and it's at the discretion of the rider ultimately and the chief mechanic, who at this point is basically the information hub, who talks to the tire person and the data acquisition person, and he makes the last say as far as, okay, I think this would be a good idea to try this. We're going to send you out for 5 laps with something just a little bit changed this way. And then after 5 laps, the rider will give his feedback. They'll come to a decision like, okay, we want to go in this direction. The chief will obviously have a direction he believes is the best way to go. And then the rider goes out and the performance either confirms it or shows it to be the wrong direction. As far as base settings, you know, we've got quite a bit of changes we can do to the bike, not just things like springs and ride height, but fork angle, offset, swing arm pivot. And that's quite extensive to go through the entire range of changes for one track, especially because you don't just want to go out and try something for 5 laps, because maybe you're a little bit off, the rider, you know, might be a little bit off, or it just might feel, not good to him with that particular set of tires. So, in a way, the mystery of tuning a bike that came with the two strokes that a lot of people don't understand is translated into how to set up a bike and how to work with a rider and work with the data available.
Interesting. So now on the kind of human element, you know, you've made some changes to the bike and everything, and you send the guy out for 5 laps or whatever. How much sort of it enters into it where it's like he just sort of felt funny for those 5 laps compared to the previous 5 laps. If, I mean, that sounds kind of silly, but you know what I'm saying? I mean, is it something, do you find that there's a difference between different riders where they can go out and be just spot on consistent and sort of know that, okay, this time the front end felt a little bit different and other riders may not have that level of,
lucidity.
Yeah. You know, I mean, whatever you want, you know, they're not that closely attuned to the motorcycle. Do you find that to be true?
Yes, obviously, based on a rider's feel and his level of communication, there, you can run yourself in circles if you don't understand what the rider's telling you. We experienced something a little bit like this with Shinichi Ito and Motegi, despite him having a lot of experience riding the Ducati and experience with Bridgestone tires, sometimes it wasn't exactly clear what he was trying to say to us. So fortunately we had somebody on hand that could help translate and, you know, clarify things for us. Other riders, are just unable, it seems, to communicate exactly what the bike is doing. They can only describe it as a feeling like, the front felt funny. And then it's up to the chief and the data guy to look at the data and say, okay, this is something we noticed, because, you know, obviously the people that have been doing this for years can look at the data and say, I know exactly what's happening here. Here's some chatter. You know, we need to change the transmission ratios here because obviously we're not hitting max RPM at this point on the racetrack before the corner. Hmm. You know, it's almost mathematics at this point. You can look at the bike. We know what the bike's doing in so many different ways that you can study and go, okay, you know, we can improve here, we can improve there. You know, and it's also up to the rider to find confidence in the setup that he likes. I found, just in my personal experience, that you can change your own motorcycle backwards, forwards, left, and right. You know, and then you find something that you feel works for yourself. Or maybe it's just the settings that your motorcycle came with from the factory. But I think that the more time you spend on a bike and the more you learn how to ride that bike, the better you're going to be on it. So I've it's my personal belief that the riders that kind of generally stick with a similar setup, they're able to learn how to ride that bike at different circuits. You know, if you've got a guy that's always changing the way the front end is, and who's always changing the rear of the bike, and it's never really the same motorcycle that they're riding. Whereas if you have a guy that generally doesn't change the suspension settings too much, that generally doesn't change his motorcycle that much, you know, at this point in the season, he's had how many thousands of kilometers under his belt on the bike, 10,000 kilometers riding the bike at this point. And he's going to know exactly how that bike's going to react and what it's going to do and how hard he can push it. He knows he's found the limit of that exact combination. Which leads me to something that an Orleans technician mentioned to me, that generally the riders that have been on top lately, like Valentino Rossi for years and Casey Stoner, they don't radically modify their bike very much for the different circuits. They don't, you know, they're not changing a million shock springs. They're not changing their front forks left and right and looking for some elusive magic setting that's going to find them a half second or a second. They know they got to work. They know their motorcycle. They spend a lot of time riding their bike and, you know, they learned how to ride it. So for me, I think, ideally that would be the guy to work with.
So, but is it safe to say that even, you know, Valentino Rossi and Casey Stoner and all that, where they're so in tune with their motorcycle and stuff, do they make some kind of changes from one circuit to another?
Of course. Okay. Of course. You know, they might have three or four shock springs that they prefer to use because they're familiar with how those shock springs work with the bike. They know what the bike is going to do, how it's going to react. It doesn't seem like they try and find a magical mystery setting that all of a sudden everything clicks into place and they go, ah, okay, all of a sudden, boom, you know.
Right.
You know, they have a good setting and then a small range where they say, okay, we're going to fine tune it in this direction or that direction. But then, you know, their base setting is really good. I think we talked about this a little bit earlier when the discussion about wet weather setups came up, where some riders have to have a radically different rain setting as far as the front end and in order for them to get the feeling of the tires on the wet pavement or if it's raining.
Right.
And then if the circuit dries out a little bit, they're not able to go faster. Whereas other riders, Anthony West in particular and Stoner, they don't radically change the bike between their dry weather setting and their wet weather setting. So, you know, if they do go out in the rain and then it dries up, they're still able to ride at a brisk pace.
Without setting up the bike differently or having it. Yeah, yeah. Huh. Interesting. So that's cool. That's great stuff. And actually, you kind of answered the second part of JT's question there when you went into it, because he had also asked it's how you guys interpret rider feedback. You know, do the riders say sort of vague things like I was losing the front end, or do they say very specific things like you need to adjust this, you know, rebound or compression or whatever?
And up to the rider. Some riders have that ability to know what the bike is going to do if they say, oh, I want 2 clicks of rebound or one click of preload. Or, you know, some guys are able to absorb that and able to use that kind of information, and other riders don't. And, you know, it's tough to say. You can't point a finger at somebody and say, oh, you're a shitty test rider, or you give rotten feedback.
Right.
Because everybody's different. But generally, team managers, you know, they look for things like that before they pick up a rider. Or, you know, somebody should be looking at that kind of information. How much feedback can the rider give you? How accurate can it be? Because if the rider is able to give the accurate, good feedback, then everybody improves. Right. Then, you know, Bridgestone knows what they have to do. Then Ducati can say, ah, okay, that's what this kind of engine braking is feeling like for this guy. Or the more clear you're able to be, the better off you are.
Okay. Do you think that when you were saying that some riders that you have this sort of problem working, like you're talking with Ito, and that sounded like it was clearly a language barrier, is it often a language barrier thing, or is it sometimes that the riders may not fully grasp, you know, like myself, I'm riding a motorcycle and And I just know it feels a little funny. So I had my suspension tuned and I told the guy, I said, it feels like this. And he says, oh, you need this and that. So, I mean, when you have those kind of things, is it how much of it is language barrier versus rider just is simply for whatever reason, not calling it a bad thing, he's ignorant of exactly what happens in the motorcycle when you adjust those settings?
Generally, I would say it's not a language barrier. There's enough multilingual people in the paddock that you can figure something out. I mean, my chief mechanic, most of the people on my team are trilingual. Or, you know, we've got guys that speak French even on our team besides Spanish, English, Italian. We can handle most of the riders that will come up to us. In the case of a Japanese rider, sometimes they have a Japanese chief mechanic or mechanic that can assist them in translating into another language when they want to be extra clear about something. In the case of somebody like Alberto Pooch, that's got a lot of experience raising young riders, you know, gradually teaching them how to understand, you know, some riders will actually study their data and will learn from that. And we'll see, oh, okay, the bike is doing this once I've made this change, you know. So gradually, the more they learn, the more they understand, the better they're able to be. But someone like Pooch will come in, and I've heard this from Hito, where they'll say something basic like, let's say something, for example, brakes. You come in, and the question will be brakes, 1 to 10. How good is it? You know, and you say, oh, okay, brakes are working. I feel they're 9 out of 10. You know, and if you record that over enough time, you know, numbers like that, you can say, ah, okay, I have a sense of how the rider rides and how what they feel on the bike, and you know how to make improvements based off of that.
Interesting. Moving on, let's see. One of the other emails I got that I thought was a good one, and this one is from, who is it from? It says it's from you, but I know it's not because I'm reading your reply to his thing. This is from David in New Zealand. And David in New Zealand asks, he says, at the start of the race, have the slicks been scrubbed in, or has the mold release been removed on the tires, or are they kind of quite slippery for the first few laps? And he asked this because, you know, when you buy a regular old set of, you know, civilian road tires, it's big warning stickers all over the place about don't do anything crazy for the first 100 miles and this and that and the other. And we know, you know, if we're at a track day or whatever, you go out and put a lap in or two on them and sort of take it easy. So how does that relate to a specific, you know, a MotoGP racing slick? What have they done to those tires to make it so that rider's not going to go out there and crash right off the bat?
Well, I don't think we've got the same type of mold release. We have a release that is set so that the tires will pop out of the mold. Geez, I just kind of said the same thing, didn't I? We don't have the same long-lasting kind of mold release. You know, I would say, you know, the different tire manufacturers, their tires feel different just even sitting on the tire rack before they're mounted to the tires. I was amazed by how different the Dunlops felt last year when I ran my hand over them versus the Bridgestones this year. Tactically, they're very different. Obviously, the tires are heated up with tire warmers, and we don't use any kind of substance or fuel or whatever to remove any layer from the Bridgestone tires this year. We didn't do it with the Dunlops last year either. The rider goes out, takes it easy on their outlap, and then usually by then the tires are ready to rock and roll. On a tire with such a short lifespan as this, you don't really need a preservative of sorts because you're going to use this tire this weekend for this race because it's been set up for this racetrack, or maybe you'll use it the next race or the race after that. But there's really a short lifespan for these tires, and they don't need the preservatives. I have seen them taking something that seemed to be mold release off the 125 and 250 tires, but I don't really have any experience with those rubber compounds. Like, I've never really seen them up close or played with them. I just know what I've seen just being in the paddock and seeing a 125 team next to me and, it looks like he's scrubbing down the wheels with gasoline. You know.
Gasoline, really? Wow.
I don't know, honestly. We don't do anything like that with GP tires. We give the wheels to Bridgestone, they throw the tires on it, we put them in the tire warmers, and they go on the bike, the rider goes out, and the magic happens.
Yeah. Now, when you pull the tire warmers off, are the tires already sticky?
Not anywhere near like what they are when they come back in.
Right.
I mean, they are tacky when they come in sometimes, especially after qualifying. I don't think I've ever felt anything like a qualifying tire in MotoGP.
Sure. Well, a regular street tire, you know, the old Dunlop qualifier, you go out and put a few laps on that on a track day, and when you come back in, it's sticky. You know, I mean, it feels like goo a little bit, you know, and it's picking up little rocks and stuff like that. So I'm sure that a MotoGP tire has got to be crazy sticky. And can you tell us, without giving away any secrets of the farm or anything, how hot do you heat those tires roughly in those tire warmers? Or is that something I shouldn't ask?
I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Too hot to touch?
So they're warm, put it that way.
There you go. They're nice and warm and toasty. Yeah,
I mean, if you think about what you're going to get out of, a Michelin Pilot's Power Sport, you know, or one of the DOT legal race tires, if you go out and do a track day on that and feel your tire after you come in, you know, it's a little bit hotter than that, but they're pretty similar.
Yeah.
You know, the technology just trickled down, which is why I'm really disappointed by the thought of going to a control tire.
You're stealing my next question, Liam. But yeah, let's go ahead and talk about it. No, it's a good one. You go ahead and run with it. Let's talk about the control tire and what you can tell us, whatever you've heard, whatever you think, whatever it is you want to talk about. Let's talk about the control tire.
All right. Well, there's been a lot of good information thrown out left and right on various forums. Some good threads about it on Ride On 2 or Bay Area Riders Forum. A lot of things. Dennis Noyes wrote a nice column about it recently on Speed. My personal take on it is it's a kind of a dumbing down of the series. And I think there's some things that people don't really consider. I think everybody's thinking that, the ones in favor are thinking, it's going to be great racing again. You know, everyone's going to have access to the same material. Everyone's going to be going head to head. You know, you could have 15 riders come in through the first corner and everybody's got the same chance, fighting for the lead. But I noticed a couple things wrong with that from my perspective. And the first and foremost thing is that the factories are always going to want the factories to do best, better than any of the satellites. And there's a myriad of ways to detune a satellite bike, or just not even have it anywhere near the same level that the factory bike is. And this is natural because the factory spends all their money in development and engineering, so the factory can do the best. And so that's one thing. Factories are going to do better no matter what. That's not going to change if we go to a control tire. Two, you have such individual riding styles at this speed, at this level, and with these prototype bikes that a lot of times the setup of the bike, the way the bike reacts and handles, is set up for the way the rider rides it and also how he reacts with the tires. Some riders can't use tires that other riders can use, not at all. This is pretty evident when you look at somebody with, say, Gary McCoy. He was able to ride his tires very differently, and he needed very different tires. As soon as you put him on a more standard tire that worked for most of the paddock, he wasn't able to do what he did with them. And the only current rider that I can think of that's similar is Tony Elias, and currently riding for Grassini on Bridgestone. I had a Bridgestone guy mention to me that, you know, when they started working with that team, the progress and development made with Marco Melandri was fairly straightforward. It was step by step. Oh, okay, he likes this. This is working well for him. Next race, we're going to go to this. Working well for him. It was pretty linear. Whereas, with Tony Elias, he presented such a range of issues that they had to go to the top at Bridgestone and say, wow, we need to make something special for this kid because the regular stuff's not doing it and he's not able to get up there. So I think if you put somebody like Tony Elias or Danny Pedrosa on a standard tire, they're really going to struggle quite a bit. And I don't think that's going to mean that the control tire was a good thing necessarily. We'll be losing out on quite an exciting style of riding.
Yeah. Have you heard anything of more details about the whole control tire, about how they might do it? Is it going to be like something stupid like Formula One where there's only two tires to choose from? Or well, even in World Superbike, they have three, A, B, and C, right?
I haven't heard anything specific, to be honest with you. It seemed like the news kind of shocked everybody in Motegi. I've had some Skype conversations and some emails with various people within the last 2 weeks, but I haven't gotten any kind of clarity on it.
Yeah.
I think everybody even, you know, all the workers, we're in the dark about it until something is said in Malaysia.
Yeah.
So it's a strange time to think, wow, next year might be good and bad, and who knows? I hate the thought of getting beaten by World Superbike in lap times.
Oh, yeah, no kidding. That would be bad. And this, I mean, chances are some of these decisions haven't even been made yet, let alone sort of, you know, trickle down to paddock gossip or wherever you're getting your information. And one thing, I don't know if you get Cycle News, you probably might not get the weekly magazine Cycle News, but Michael Scott, who he's an international writer, so you might have read the column somewhere else or something, or if you haven't, he's got a column in the October 3rd edition of Cycle News, issue number 39, Say It Isn't So. And well, I think Michael's been listening to my podcast because he's basically saying the same thing that I've been saying. But the gist of it is that it's a the MotoGP is the last major series to not use a control tire, and that this is going to be the triumph of commercialism over sport in terms of racing being a sport of engineers and artisans competing against one another, and blah, blah, blah.
I completely agree.
Yeah, it's a great article. I'll have to find – I just took a quick look on the internet to see if I could find it. I couldn't – some way or another, I'll get you the article so you can read it, because it's more of an opinion piece than an article.
I'll just ask him in Australia.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, so
that's the benefit of being around. Sometimes I could just throw something out like, hey, Toby, what'd you write on Autosport? And, you know, Toby will let me know what he thinks, and It's fun like that, at least, to be closer in certain ways.
Yeah, I'll bet it's fun. You're killing me here, Liam, man. You're making me look, you know. But that's okay.
Yeah, but you got it a week before I did, right?
So, yeah, you know. But it's a super, yeah, it's a super good
definitely
piece.
Commercialism. And it's driven not so much, I think, by the riders and teams saying, oh, we need Bridgestone, we need Bridgestone, we need Bridgestone. But you know, the television viewership numbers this year have been drastically different than in years past. And you can look at it two ways, like the runaway victories by Stoner or by Pedrosa or whatever have made it boring, so people aren't tuning in. But I think if you look from another perspective that, you know, as Rossi won consecutive championship and then another consecutive championship and then another one, his fan base only increased and more people watched. And then last year when they watched him lose, it was like, eh. And this year, by mid-season, everyone was like, oh, he's not going to win. Ducati's too strong. The package is right. Stoner's riding the wheels off of it. You know, really, people want to see their guy win.
Yeah.
And whether a lot of people admit it or not, I think everyone wanted to see him up there this year. So this control tire thing is in part a little bit of a fast reaction to that. Like, oh, our boy didn't even have a chance.
Let's throw a control tire on the bike and everything will be leveled out. Kind of, yeah.
Right. Not going to happen.
Right.
I think also what we're going to see in the control tires is some bikes work better with certain control tires. You know, if they give us a, you know, what they call a wooden tire that is theoretically going to work well for everybody, some bikes are just going to have a chassis and a TC that maximizes that tire better than everyone else. And then we've got factories that are detuning their bikes to work best with a substandard tire. And I don't know, you know, one piece of the equation always bleeds off into another piece. You know, you modify one thing and then you got to modify something else. And it's a circle of evolution. And by bringing the tires down a level, we are going to lose that cutting edge pressure to really push new ideas and new solutions. I think the best thing I've heard about it, I can't remember exactly who it came from. I think it was probably from Julian Ryder. But Julian mentioned, you know, the factories spend millions and millions and millions on this program just to go racing in MotoGP because it's the top of the heat. I mean, if you have a problem, you've maximized your engine. You've maximized, you know, everything you can do with the chassis. Your electronics is up there. You can request, hey, Michelin or Bridgestone, Dunlop, can you give us something a little bit more like this? You know, our shit data looks like this, and your data looks like that. Come on, you know, what can we do? You've got more options. If you go to a control tire that seems to be working well, you know, obviously they'll make improvements. The tire manufacturer will make improvements. improvements over time to that tire. We saw that with Pirelli and World Superbike. First year, not so good. Second year, better. Third year, they gradually improved the tires that worked well with everybody. But what they're neglecting is that in MotoGP, if we've got a tire that's not at the limit, for that bike, why should the manufacturer spend all this money? Why should they devote so much of their engineers and their staff to making the best motorcycle? It's kind of like, being in a training program. You've got this guy that's a really good sprinter, and you've got a nutritionist and a trainer and a facility, and you do everything you can to make this guy do the 100 meter dash as faster than ever before. And then Nike says, well, we're not going to give you the shoes, you're just going to go to socks. Everybody involved is going to be, well, why the hell are we working so hard if you're just going to be out there running around on socks, it's an odd thing to say, but it will affect my enthusiasm for this series quite a bit if it comes to pass.
I've got several points to make about all of that, because first of all, though, before I go into those points, I want to real quick, you said they call it a wooden tire. What do you mean by wooden tire?
Just, it's not going to have the same level of tactile feel to everybody. One thing that happens a lot is after a break, say 2 weeks, like we've had just now, pre-practice one is going to roll around and everybody goes out on a fairly wooden tire. You're not going to get the best tire on the bike for your first session out after you've had 2 weeks off of riding the bike. You get a tire that's pretty good, so you can kind of get back into the groove. You work your way up into it, raising your lap times as you relearn the circuit, as you get a handle on the bike setup, as you improve throughout the weekend. You want to set your target up so that, okay, we think this tire is pretty good, so you'll start with that. Then the next tire is going to be a little bit better. Hopefully we've adjusted the setup to maximize that better tire. And the third tire you're going to try is a little bit better than that. That's kind of what you do. So that's why you never see someone go out in free practice one, have immediately a good feeling with the bike and set these amazing lap times and then is not able to improve over the weekend. You never go out on your best tire. This idea of a wooden tire is that you just set up just a base tire that's going to generally work well with everybody, but it's not going to be really good for anybody. I think we're going to have a lot more crashes if we go to a control tire, as everyone tries to find that limit and everyone's going to step over the limit because, for years now they've had better tires.
Yeah. Huh. That's an interesting concept.
I would think, and this is just speculation, so I want to be clear that it's just an idea of mine, that were we to go to a control tire, I think the times would be slower than satellite teams that maybe don't have access to the top level tire. I think it's going to bring everybody down to a level a few seconds back from where we're at now.
Interesting. Oof. Yeah. And the thing is also going back to the whole thing, we can't deny that World Superbike seems to have benefited from the control tire. I mean, it certainly has. I mean, they're having a great season this year as far as good races to watch and all of that. And like you said, 2003, not so great, it progressed. So we can kind of point to the control tire. And I think Formula One's the same way. NASCAR, that I pay absolutely zero attention to, is probably that same way and all of that. So from that side of things, for MotoGP, if it's only about TV viewership, then okay, maybe the spec tire will work. But how do you think, other than the fact that both of us seem to agree that we want this tire development because we want better tires for our bikes, so other than that, how do you think that a control tire might harm MotoGP? We've talked about slower lap times. We've talked about less development. What other factors might come into play on that, why it's a bad idea?
First off, by going to a control tire, the lap times will go down. And I think the factories will put less emphasis on developing the machines, because these machines are built to run solutions that will trickle down to street bikes. I think if we neuter the GP series, a bunch of engineers are going to migrate over to pushing World Superbike development for their street bike line, which may have benefits, more instantaneous benefits for the street rider.
Sure.
What I've noticed is that it seems that factories will try ideas in GP, and that will work its way down to World Superbike, and then from there it works down to the street bike. If we neuter GP, we're going to lose that prototype testing bed, and the solutions will then be tried in World Superbike, I think.
Okay.
It's tough to say. I mean, I can't look into the future and say, oh, okay, maybe in 2 years GP is going to be back on top. I don't know. It really depends on who the control tire developer is and how much money they're willing to throw at it to make something that works well for everybody.
Right.
I have mentioned that what I've noticed in World Superbike is that the tires, depending on the circuit, benefit different manufacturers better. And this is why I say sometimes the Yamahas are there, sometimes the Ducatis are really strong, sometimes the Honda's strong. All things being equal, I think we're going to find the same thing in GP with a control tire, that, oh, okay, maybe on this particular circuit, say Jerez, the Yamahas are going to do great. The longer stretch, maybe the Ducati's just going to blow everybody out of the water. I don't know. I do know that the bikes have generally caught up with one another as far as straight line speed. You know, everybody's got a strong engine under the hood at the factory level. And I don't know. I just really want the tire war to keep on going. I don't say, oh, yes, Bridgestone good, or, oh, you know, Michelin did a great race. And I don't cheer for the tires, but it needs to be there.
I agree. And yeah, that's been another argument, is nobody goes to a race and cheers for their tire team or something like that. But no, I think we are. We're definitely both on the same page of the whole thing, of that it's just part of the whole package, and it should be.
I think it boils down to different levels of fan. The fans that just like to watch the races on TV, the general fan, the casual fan, the bar fan, the one that knows, oh, Rossi rides a Yamaha, but really couldn't tell you what Fiat was, or, you know, the general fan wants to see a control tire and just wants to see close racing. And I agree with that on one level, because I love watching close races. To me, that's what makes it really count. That makes a beautiful race for me. And it doesn't have to be the top three. I think if the television director or whoever was in charge, that Dorna focused on some of the other riders that were dicing it up. I mean, there's usually a five-rider battle somewhere around 10th place or between 3 and 8. You know, there's always good battles going on, but they just focus on the top three.
Sure.
No one really cheers for a tire, but, you know, each tire, the three companies, they raise the level of their game based on what the other one's doing. And this is just a down year for Michelin. You know, they started with a 16-inch front tire, which affected quite a few things at the beginning of the season. Everybody seems to have forgotten that. That was kind of a radical change after so many years of running the 16.5. I don't know what's going to happen next year. I think after a year of them developing the 16 front, they're going to keep doing that because it makes sense. I mean, if I think about it, it makes sense.
Assuming they're still in MotoGP, that is, you know. Okay. When we talk about
a world without Michelin, that's a strange.
I know. It's kind of scary, isn't it?
Strange idea.
Yeah, it's somewhat horrifying.
I'm more curious as to who Kenny Roberts is going to be running engines from next season.
Oh wow! But tell us what you're thinking here, Liam. Where are we getting this?
Well, there's a little blurb on it on Crash.net. But they want to run two riders in order to get their sponsor. They need to run two riders. And Honda's not able to provide them with two engines or two riders worth of engines. So it looks like they're looking around for another supplier. And it's quite possible that after the first year of running the 800s, you know, the factories have figured out what they need. And, you know, who knows who they're going to get an engine from. It's possible it's an outside guy that's not in MotoGP right now. It's possible it's an inside guy, somebody that's currently doing well in MotoGP.
Sure. Have you seen anywhere around the paddock or anything like that? Are we possibly going to see the return of the Ilmor as an engine supplier?
I haven't heard anything about that. I haven't seen anybody. Well, I saw a truck driver / mechanic from Ilmor a couple of races ago. but yeah, it was just more like he came to enjoy the race. It's an interesting idea. I mean, obviously, Aprilia had a great MotoGP engine. They just didn't have the electronics to do it right.
Right.
Ilmor apparently had a hell of an engine. It sounded like, you know, something from another world. I could barely stay in my garage when they fired up next to us in the garage next door. You know, who knows what they've been doing this last year away from the racetrack, you know, as far as trying to tame it or make it more rideable.
Yeah. I don't know. And it does, unfortunately, it always all boils down to money in so many different ways. And that's why we're looking at this specter of a spec tire and the fact that Ilmor's gone and why haven't we seen the Moto Sis yet and on and on and on of all these different things. It always boils down to money. And I don't know about you, but one thing that I'm afraid of, if we go to the spec tire rule, and this is also mentioned in Michael Scott's column, it's something I've said before, that it's a slippery slope. That after that, okay, let's go to the control tire. Well, then we'll have a control ECU or, you know, this and that and the other. And I mean, is that something that you, that is enough of a concern that you would sort of see that as a possibility as well?
Tough to say. You know, honestly, Formula One is doing it and they're being the biggest racing game in town means that everybody looks at them to kind of show the way, so to speak. I don't know if the series were eventually to go to a spec ECU and spec tires and spec everything, and I lost my drive for it, I would look for work in a different form of racing. I think personally, there's a lot to be had in World Superbike and also in the AMA. And, you know, I've always kind of had a soft spot for flat track, and I don't know. There might come a point in my life where I just want to give some of my experiences to younger riders. My perspective is watching, you know, how riders grow in GP, what I've seen out here. I'm not sure because, you know, obviously money is the root of everything, like you just mentioned. Spec ECU. Yeah, I think you just kind of knocked me for a loop there. What a horrible idea.
I agree. It's terrible stuff.
Thank God these bikes are so complicated right now that it would be a real, real fair for somebody to come up with a computer that would run all the bikes. I think the biggest problem with that is how do you find somebody that's trustworthy enough that can take all the different data from these different manufacturers and not, you know, find a way to leak it somehow. You know, if they know, oh, okay, because, you know, the different manufacturers use different systems to understand what the bike is doing. Some guys rely more on, you know, certain sensors than other guys do, just to kind of be vague about it.
Yeah, sure. Well, that's the answer to that is you could do exactly what Formula One is doing, where you have the team that's involved in this big spy scandal combined with Microsoft, everybody's favorite company, making the ECU. So I think that's hopefully we never see that in MotoGP. But, so I don't know. I think this has been a great call, Liam. I think we should probably let you go ahead and get back to your packing. We've been 45-odd minutes here chatting away on a call.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know. We said we'd take half an hour, and it's the usual thing. So,
well, I hope everybody still enjoys MotoGP. Casey Stoner, I just want to give a massive congratulations to him. And then secondly, I want to give it to Ducati Corsa. I think Casey did a hell of a job this year. And I think he came in strong enough that had he been on something, say, the Kawasaki, he would have been winning races and might have been a title contender. You know, I really can't say enough good things about the kid. It was a neat experience in Motegi, kind of watching that garage because that was the weekend, and I had some contact with them, and I watched his mother and father. The mom was so nervous during the race. I mean, she stood in the back of the garage, smoked a cigarette. She'd stand up on something to kind of watch the screen from outside the garage proper. You could just really feel the tension with her, you know, and it was like she was worried for some reason. I don't know. It was in my mind, that was Rossi's race. I mean, he came from seventh and stormed past everybody, and had he pulled a better switch on the tires, it could have been a magical thing. But that was an interesting race, and unfortunately, personally, I still don't really like the bike switching thing, because it seems more than anything, it's the timing of the bike switch that plays into the outcome of that race. But it was nice to see Kawasaki finally get a podium, because I know those mechanics that work on Randy's bike, and those are some really hard-working boys. I mean, they fix a lot of bikes. So for them to get a podium was just really, really gratifying for me to see. I took some time to go over to the podium celebration because I wanted to see them crown a world champion. I missed it with Nicky Hayden last year at Valencia. So I walked across the track and I watched them crown Stoner and I watched Loris, you know, up on the podium. And it was just really a neat feeling to watch these crazy Italians going nuts. You know, the little factory that could, they did it.
Yeah.
And just on the one hand, you know, it was all Stoner. And on the other hand, Ducati really gave him a platform that he blended well with. You know, he's got the feeling for that bike, and the development for the GP8 is based a lot off of him. So, I expect to see him do even better next year, if all things being equal, if the tires are the same and so on. I have one of the cool little Ducati Corsa headbands that everybody was wearing, because obviously we're still working on getting the best out of these bikes. So when Casey was trying to fix some things with the clutch, I provided some pieces, you know, to try a different solution and vice versa. You know, we kind of flow back and forth, our two teams, as we look for the best we can get out of the machines. And it was neat to kind of say that in some indirect way, I was a part of this because I do work with these factory guys and I know who they are. And I was just really proud of everybody. You can't imagine that this little team of Corsa within 5 years could win the championship. It's just, you know, everything kind of fell into place. It was a good move to go to Bridgestone a few years back. It was a great move to get Stoner. Just everything kind of fell into place for them this year. And I hope that he's able to repeat in the following years. On that same token, I hope that Nicky's able to get something good under him, because I really admire his work ethic and the way he just keeps his head down and rides his heart out. So I'd like him to fight for wins in the future. You know, I read a lot of things on the internet when I have time. It's a nice way for me to stay involved kind of with racing back in the U.S., what people are thinking, and, you know, how I decompress a little bit. And it's, you know, something that I'm generally interested in, genuinely. I care about it. So I read a lot of things that downplayed Nicky's championship or downplayed Casey's championship. And the bottom line is anybody that wins a championship kicked ass that year.
Exactly.
In one way or another.
I agree.
Because it is a long season.
Yeah.
And, this is my first full season with preseason and, you know, working on 2007 last year before I went home for Christmas. It's just, it's a war. Like Bob McLean said in Faster, this is a real war. And, it ain't over yet. You know, they've got the championship, but we've still got three more races. And that's all I'm going to think about right now. I got to focus on Chaz Davies. And on a side note, I just want to wish Alex Hoffman well, whatever he ends up doing. It's been a lot of races we worked together. And I wish him the best no matter what happens for him.
Sure. Yeah. Understood. So right on. Well, best of luck at Phillip Island. If we can, you know, it probably won't be able to get to talk to you between Phillip Island and Malaysia with the communication difficulties and stuff. So best of luck there too. I'm sure we'll be exchanging some emails if all else fails, and we'll check out your MotoLiam.com website and all of that. So it's been great, Liam. Really enjoyed talking to you.
Okay, thanks everybody in MotoGPOD land. Keep listening to Bob. Check out your forums. Stay active in motorcycles. Watch the races. What else?
I think that
eat a really good hamburger for me.
Oh yeah, I'm gonna have one in a little bit. So.
Man, I really just want like a fat cheeseburger.
Well, you get to come over to America
next year. What they can do in Australia.
Right on. Thanks a lot, Liam.
See you, everybody.
That's going to do it for today's show. I hope you enjoyed it a lot. One of the things we didn't talk about that I normally try to mention is the time of the race. If you're actually going to watch it live on MotoGP.com, Australia is still doing their standard time or whatever they call it at this point because of the whole business. So right now, as of October 12th, they are 17 hours ahead of Pacific time. So basically that boils down to meaning that the race will be at 10 p.m. on Saturday night Pacific time, which means 1 a.m. Eastern time, 1 a.m. Sunday morning for the Eastern folks. And as far as Europe, what's going on there, I guess it would be, I don't know. You guys are going to figure it out. Check out the MotoGP.com website to figure out the time. It starts getting confusing around this time of year because you've got different countries going to standard time and all of that at various different times. And Australia is heading into their summer. And it's just all very, very confusing. So we have got that going on. Like I said, 10 p.m. Saturday night Pacific time, 1 a.m. Eastern time for Sunday morning. The race will be live on MotoGP.com. It is also broadcast in the United States on Speed Channel. And that is going to be at, let's see, what time is it going to be at here real quick? We're taking a quick look at the schedule. It's going to be at 3 p.m. Pacific time, which means 6 p.m. Eastern time, Sunday. So Sunday on Speed Channel at 3 p.m. if you watch your races on Speed, or 6 p.m. if you're on the East Coast, you will see the MotoGP World Championship races there at Phillip Island. And like I said earlier on, trust me, it's going to be a really, really good race. Lots of good stuff going on, so I definitely encourage you to watch it. I'll try to be there in the chat room. May or may not be in there. Might have some stuff going on at tentatively planned at this time, so I'm not 100% sure what's going to be happening Saturday night, but if I'm available, I'll be there with you guys doing the chat room, and if not, there's going to be a bunch of other fun people in there too, and I encourage you to take a listen to that. So, all of that said, I hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you very much for downloading it. The email address here, if you want to make a comment or something like that, is always bob@motogpod.com. And I love to hear from you. I answer every email. So send me an email. The website, we have a website, motogpod.com, and there's a section where you can put comments in. Something is going on. Something is broken with the comments thing, and I don't even know that there's always comments, and some comments seem to be getting lost, and a wide variety of things. So if you placed a comment there on the website and I did not reply, which I haven't because I didn't even realize there was any comments going up, and I thought it was kind of strange, and then I suddenly discovered, wow, look, there's a few comments. But if you've placed a comment up there, obviously I haven't replied, and I apologize for that, but just send me an email and I'll reply something back. We're going to get that fixed, that whole thing on the website of what's going on with the comments. We're making lots of progress on that website, and we are adding features and bringing back features that used to be on the old website and all sorts of stuff. And other than that, I think that's going to about do it. If you want to read an article that I read that was just fantastic stuff on Speed TV's website about why is Dorna threatening to impose a spec tire rule, and it's an article by Dennis Noyes. He's always good for MotoGP opinion, and I will put a link up for that. It's on the speedtv.com website and in article section for MotoGP, but whatever, find the link on motogpod.com and follow that to the Speed TV website. Fascinating article by Dennis Noyes. There's been a lot of talk about it. This is big news, the spec tire thing. Everybody is up in arms about it. Cycle News, Road Racing World, Speed TV with Dennis Noyes, all of these people, everybody's got something to say about it one way or the other. It's very, very interesting stuff. We're going to be finding out what's going on for that for next season. And we should have an official announcement made here shortly, according to the unofficial announcements earlier on. They're going to be telling us here what's going to be happening here in the next few weeks. But if you read some of these articles, you'll find out this is not leaving any factory, with a tire factory, I mean, with a lot of time going on to start ramping up to build these tires. So I'm just not sure what they're planning on doing. It's all kind of a bit of a mystery. But that's going to do it for tonight. Thank you very much again for downloading the show, and I will talk to you next week. MotoGPOD listeners, I have a small favor to ask of you. This show costs money to produce. I have bandwidth and hosting bills to pay, domain name registrations, phone bills, and a variety of other expenses. This Skype bill alone is getting a little scary, with calls to Liam running me somewhere around 30 cents a minute right now, what with a dollar's free fall plunge against the euro, which is how I have to buy Skype credits. I haven't been finding any advertisers since I got back from Iraq, haven't even been particularly looking for them, since I really don't want the show to become too commercial in any case. So, seeing as MotoGPOD is the national public radio of motorcycle road racing, much like NPR, I am asking you that if you enjoy the show, if you like what you hear, please consider making a small donation to the cause. There's a link on the left side of MotoGPOD.com. It's quick and painless through PayPal, and every little bit will help me make the show that much better and keep it going on a regular schedule. Because without listeners like you, there wouldn't be a MotoGPOD. One thing that you can always count on about MotoGPOD is that there will be the little disclaimer at the end, and that I'll try to make it slightly less boring by maybe trying to make it funny. Whether or not it's funny is entirely up to the listener. However, please bear with me when I tell you that MotoGPOD is produced by Bob Hayes, and I am solely responsible for its content. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorner Sports SL, and the MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorner Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners, and MotoGPOD.com is not affiliated with any of them. I actually threw in another extra .com. I was just going to say MotoGPOD is not affiliated with any of them, but because I'm sort of reading this and rambling on and on, got .com kind of thrown in there. So this you could listen to over and over again if you wanted to go to sleep, because it's a little bit of lawyerese that we throw in here at the end of the show to say that MotoGPOD is produced by me and that Dorna doesn't sort of even acknowledge my existence.